Part T. Trial. Jesus is tried by the Sanhedrin and shuffled off to Herod, who ridicules him. The traitor Judas has second thoughts.
A man who broke the law outrageously no longer need be treated with respect. Abuse, in fact, was what the man deserved. The guards and soldiers had their bit of fun. They jeered and spat and covered both his eyes and played an ancient, cruel children's game the Greeks called kolobikse. One by one, they all gave him a punch. After each blow, the cry went up, "Who struck you? Prophesy! You claim to be the Christ, then prophesy!" Still dark, the Sanhedrin, all 71 of them we can assume, had gathered as a court to try in haste this Nazarene on unsupported charges in dispute. Undoubtedly this was irregular. The high priest Caiaphas was in the chair. The man before them no doubt bore the marks, the blood and bruise of punching and misuse. This fact made little difference to the court, for innocent or guilty legally, they had decided well before they met that he must be dispatched without delay. The charge was made that Jesus said that he would devastate the temple on his own, and without further help from human hands, within 3 days, would build another one. Though witness after witness took the stand, their testimonies did not correspond. Charge after charge was seen to contradict. Jesus made no attempt to intervene. To everyone's surprise, he said no word. Here was a man in mortal danger who refused to say a word in self-defense. So this was not the way he could be trapped. The high priest chose to try another tack. The men you call disciples, what of them? And what exactly is it that you teach? But Jesus would have none of this. He said, "Why question me? What I have taught, I've taught quite publicly, in synagogues, in fields, or in the temple's precincts, anywhere where anyone who wanted to could hear. They are the ones you should be questioning. The listeners all know what I have said. Why don't you question them?" At which response, an officer smacked Jesus in the face. "Is that the way to answer the high priest? If what I have just said is not the truth, then bring in witnesses to contradict. Why use brute force when what I say is true?" Almost in desperation, Caiaphas, aware that Jesus might well slip the net, since neither by paid witnesses nor trick could he be tempted to condemn himself, then posed again the question he'd been asked by many who had seen his miracles. Did Jesus claim to be the very Christ? "I urge you, by the Blessed One himself, to tell us if you are the Son of God. Come, tell us now, in all solemnity." "Oh yes, it's as you say," was the reply. "Indeed, I'll tell you more. The day will come when you all, will see the Son of Man as David prophesied at God's right hand in clouds of glory coming down from heaven." The high priest knew his psalms and recognized at once the implications of the claim. This man had turned the tables. He would rule. And someday he would judge their makeshift trial. Whatever qualms of conscience troubled him, the wily Caiaphas could see at once that Jesus, by these words, condemned himself. the man whose wisdom and whose innocence frustrated all their tricks and villainies by this assertion played into their hands. Outrageously, he claimed to be the Son of God. No pious Jew could stand for that. A gesture silenced all the witnesses. Triumphantly, and as the law prescribed, the high priest tore his vestments and called out, "Have we not heard enough? This blasphemy, this monstrous insult to Almighty God. You sitting here are witnesses enough. What is your verdict on the Nazarene?" And by acclaim they shouted to a man that he deserved to die. So hurriedly they dragged him off to Pontius Pilate's court, for he alone could sentence him to death. That power had been denied the Sanhedrin when Rome had conquered them and took control. In Caesarea on the coast was where the Roman procurator Pilate lived. It was unusual for him to be sojourning in Jerusalem, and no doubt he felt a public celebration, such as Passover, deserved a Roman eye and an emphatic hint of Roman power. This suited the Sanhedrin perfectly. They rushed with Jesus, now condemned, en masse, towards the Roman governor's residence. The time for trial was the crack of dawn. That was the Roman way, and Passover was almost on them. Normally, his court, where he alone was judge, took place inside the palace that he used as headquarters while in Jerusalem. The members of the Sanhedrin could not go there that day. They would undoubtedly defile themselves. Thus, all the Jewish notables were forced to make a clamour just outside the doors of the praetorium. How Pilate must have sighed. More trouble he could do without. So, swallowing his pride, he compromised and went outside himself to face the fray. "Why bring this fellow here to me?" he asked. "Take him away and judge him for yourselves. You've laws and courts enough. Why bother me?" "But we are not allowed to execute, and this man's crimes are such that he should die. And you will think so when you hear him speak. He claims to be the Christ, the King of Jews." It is of note that this was not the charge on which the guilt of Jesus was pronounced. The charge was blasphemy, and that infringed no Roman law, and therefore no concern of Pilate as the Roman governor. The introduction of a regal claim, designed to show that Jesus was a threat to Roman rule, was much the better bet. Rebellion and insurgency, they knew, was what would spark the governor's interest. So Pilate signaled Jesus to go in, while those accusing him still stayed outside. What happened next is quite remarkable. Jesus and Pontius Pilate seemed to talk, as it were, man to man. No voices raised. The tone is almost philosophical. "You've heard what they're saying in the street, that you misguide the people and forbid the payment of the Roman tax and claim to be a king, the king of all the Jews. What is it you can say in your defense?" But Jesus offered no defense at all. Here was a man who might be crucified, who made no move at all to save himself. The governor could not believe his ears. "I'll ask you once again, are you indeed the King of all the Jews?" Jesus replied at last, "So tell me, do you just repeat what you have heard outside, or could it be that you do genuinely one to know. I don't know if you are or if you're not. Am I a Jew? All that I know is this. The priests and dignitaries of your tribe have passed you on to me. What have you done? My royal throne is of another world. My soldiers would be fighting for me now, to save me from the clutches of the men outside, if I were claiming to be king of territory of the kind Rome rules. The kingdom that I claim is not that kind.
Right then, said Pilate, so you are a king.
I am indeed, and that is why I'm here. The reason I was born was to proclaim the truth, and everyone who seeks the truth will listen to my words and follow me.
Ah, yes, but what is truth? Said Pilate. He'd heard enough and went out to the crowd. I find no fault in this man, he announced. He should be tried and sentenced by your law.
The furious explosions of offense that greeted this announcement and the spleen and anger it engendered were all plain. Among the voices raised were those who said that Jesus represented wider threats to Rome than any local lawbreaker. He was a Galilean who'd spread his own rebellious message far and wide. Here Pilate saw his chance.
Well, if he comes from Galilee, then I shall seek the view of Herod. That will be appropriate for now. So, as was half the world beside, Herod himself was also in Jerusalem. And when he heard the governor had sent this Galilean sorcerer he'd heard so much about for him to interview, he was delighted. He should do some tricks for him. He settled down to entertain himself.
The prisoner refused to say a word. Whatever questions he was asked, however loudly priests and scribes accused, the prisoner made no response at all. Thus, interest soon changed to ridicule. Was it a king he claimed to be? They asked. Then they would dress him up appropriately. Something bizarre, something to make them laugh, something to amuse the royal guard, something to make a mockery of his claim, something to demonstrate his pettiness. King Herod's judgment of the prisoner, far more significant than any words, was demonstrated by the way in which he sent him back to Pilate in a robe ill-fitting, gaudy, and ridiculous. Some private joke between them, not quite clear, went with him, and resulted in a change of mood, a sort of handshake between men who'd long been enemies. One thing it did, confirm what Pilate had already judged. The Nazarene did not deserve to die. It was the custom at each Passover to free a prisoner that the Romans held. The practice was designed, presumably, to curry favour with the populace by demonstrating on their festive day a leniency that was not typical of Roman rule. Pilate must make a choice. The procurator was considering his course of action when the Nazarene, this Jesus, had been brought to him for trial. He had received petitions on behalf of one Barabbas, who had made himself a reputation as a murderer, a robber, and accessory to what might well be thought of as insurgency. He was not Pilate's favoured candidate. As well as this, a message from his wife was passed to him as he took up his place upon the judgment seat from which he must pronounce the fate of the young man they called the Christ. She said she'd had a dream that night, a dream which troubled her considerably. Be sure that you set free the Nazarene. Do not condemn a just and upright man. And thus it was that Pilate sat inside, determined that he would go out and face the hostile crowd and tell them that his mind was made up to release the Nazarene. While Pilate was considering what next to do to ease his way through Passover and cause as little fuss as possible, the Jewish elders had a visitor. The man who'd helped them seize the Nazarene, now conscience-stricken, reappeared to say that Jesus was completely innocent, and furthermore that he had gravely sinned in playing any part in his arrest. The chief priests had but little time for him. If Judas the betrayer changed his tune, well, turncoats sometimes turn their coats again. The fool thought he could save the man on trial by handing back the money he'd been given. If that is what you've done, you're on your own. Don't come to us for sympathy, they said. The 30 silver pieces hit the ground, the normal price for which you'd buy a slave. The bribe which had suborned fidelity lay gleaming on the sanctuary floor, flung there by one who could no longer bear the thought of his own stupid faithlessness. A haunt where heathen kings once burnt alive their fellow men and women, Judas knew. Gehenna was close by. They called it hell. There was a gorge, steep-sided, just the place for accidents or where a man might go intent to harm himself. And there it's said that Judas hanged himself, or may have tried and slipped and left his guts caught on a rock, as what was left of him slipped down and down. But all of this was of no consequence to those to whom Iscariot went for help. Their minds were occupied with niceties. This money they now had, what could they do with it? Blood money, it was called. It was a bribe paid to a killer they had hired. To put that in the temple treasury? Oh, impossible. The law would be infringed. It was a sum of some significance. Whatever were they going to do with it?